Mark, chapter 7. If you would like to follow along this morning, afternoon, evening, whenever it happens to be, glad to have you with us and listening. Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 23. I know that sounds like a lot, but it's really not. It won't be that bad, I promise. One day, some Pharisees and teachers of religious law arrived from Jerusalem to see Jesus. They noticed that some of his disciples failed to follow the Jewish ritual of hand washing before eating. The Jews, especially the Pharisees, do not eat until they have poured water over their cupped hands, as required by their ancient traditions. Similarly, they don't eat anything from the market until they immerse their hands in water. This is but one of many traditions they have clung to, such as their ceremonial washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of religious law asked him, "Why don't your disciples follow our age-old tradition? They eat without first performing the hand-washing ceremony." Jesus replied, "You hypocrites! Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commands from God. For you ignore God's law and substitute your own tradition.'" Then he said, "You skillfully sidestep God's law in order to hold on to your own tradition. For instance, Moses gave you this law from God: honor your father and mother, and anyone who speaks disrespectfully of father or mother must be put to death. But you say it is all right for people to say to their parents, 'Sorry, I can't help you, for I have vowed to give to God what I would have given to you.'" Many of your translations right there may say Corbin at some point in there. Same idea. "In this way, you let them disregard their needy parents. And so you cancel the word of God in order to hand down your own tradition. And this is only one example among many others." Then Jesus called to the crowd to come and hear. "All of you listen," he said, "and try to understand. It's not what goes into your body that defiles you. You are defiled by what comes from your heart." Then Jesus went into a house to get away from the crowd, and his disciples asked him what he meant by the parable he had just used. "Don't you understand either?" he asked. "Can't you see that the food you put into your body cannot defile you? Food doesn't go into your heart, but only passes through the stomach and then goes into the sewer." By saying this, he declared that every kind of food is acceptable in God's eyes. And then he added, "It is what comes from inside that defiles you. For from within, out of a person's heart, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, deceit, lustful desires, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these vile things come from within. They are what defile you." Apparently the disciples' parents never told them to wash their hands before they ate. I mean, that's just good manners, and it's not bad for your health either. It's a good thing the Pharisees and the leading Jews of the day were there to correct such poor behavior. Actually, they really weren't worried about the disciples' hygiene or their health. The Jews had, for a very long time, these traditions, such as this one here about hand washing, that had originated, some say, as early as in the days of Moses. Others place it around the Babylonian exile. But they had been carried down through the years from the priesthood, and I read somewhere that there were like 1,400 of these, or some high number, all extra rules that were not in the law itself, so they were not rules given to them by God, but they were extras. Higher standards, if you will, that were given by the priests to the Jews to govern their lives, and for a long time were oral rules and laws only. They weren't even written down. At some point later, they had been written down, but for a long time, they weren't written down anywhere. And in their defense, I will admit that they may have had very good intentions for doing so. They may have very well stemmed from a desire to please God, but the truth is that they were rules that were not in the law. And yet these rules, these traditions, became just as binding on them as did the law, and in some cases, even more so. And one of these was a ceremonial hand washing before they ate, as well as washing the cups and the plates, etc. Now, it is true that in the Old Testament there are rules about ceremonial washing, including of the hands, but none for this purpose here. There was no such rule requiring that you ceremonially wash your hands before you eat. That idea came from somewhere up the priesthood. The Pharisees were concerned about the disciples being defiled, and I put that defiled in air quotes, even though you couldn't see it or hear it, because of their lack of hand washing, though I think they were more concerned about trapping Jesus in some way. And they tried to do it through the disciples. And Jesus goes on to tell them what moral purity is really made of and how one achieves that. And he does so by explaining what it is not. In short, his answer was, observing traditions and ceremonial rituals, no matter where they came from, do not make a person morally pure. It is the attitudes and actions of the heart that decide moral purity. And this message is going to address the same thing, though with some more modern illustrations and examples, because I think deep down we all want to be morally pure. We all want to be morally acceptable in the eyes of God. We all want to be a good Christian, and I put those in air quotes again as well. Sometimes, though, I think we have a false idea of how we really achieve that goal. At least it would seem that way with some of the things that we come up with. And we're going to start in the same place that Jesus did, having that uncomfortable conversation about our traditions, about those extra things that we do that we think are fitting for a Christian, but they are not found in Scripture and will not play a role in whether or not we make it to heaven, because as Jesus said, the words that he spoke will be what judges us, the Bible. And so whatever is not in the Bible will not be a basis for our judgment. And yet we spend a lot of time worrying about some of these things and taking great pains to do them and even at times insisting that others do them as well. Which is what we see here with the Pharisees and the hand washing. Yes, it was customarily done by the Jews, but it was an unwritten rule. Technically, the disciples didn't have to do it if they didn't want to. And one can argue that the disciples didn't do it not to be a problem, but because they were mature in their faith to know that they didn't need to wash. What they were doing, or not doing, if you want to look at it that way, was no problem to God. And the church has seen many of these extras come and go, these higher standards, these traditions, these things that we feel we should do or not do because that is what seems fitting for a Christian, even though they cannot be found in the Bible. And yes, I understand about conscience, and even if there is no clear direction given in the Bible with a particular circumstance, God has given us a conscience that we are to follow and be guided by. The rub with the conscience rule, though, is that it can vary from person to person, because one man's conscience may condemn him for a certain action, and another man's does not, even over the same action, and one reason for that could be that one is more mature in his faith than is the other. The Bible does indicate that this is a very real thing. Romans 14:2 says one man's faith allows him to eat everything, but another man, whose faith is weak, eats only vegetables. I could argue that my wife is weak in her faith because she prefers primarily to eat vegetables and non-meaty foods. She will eat meat every once in a while, but it's not like, you know, her go-to food or anything. You know, she doesn't exactly love meat. I, however, love a good sirloin steak. Just about any time, I love a good sirloin steak. A good bacon cheeseburger doesn't hurt either. So, you know, y'all can pray for her because she's weak in her faith. No, I'm kidding. But you get the idea that he's saying, because what to eat or what not to eat was a big deal back in the time when Romans 14 was being written. And we have big deals in our time today, speaking in terms of the Christian faith. It may not have anything to do with what we're eating, but it's the same scenario. Just substitute different items. And that entire chapter of Romans 14 is a good read on this topic, because even though eating certain foods or not eating certain foods is the basis in that chapter, situations that are much more relevant to our day and time can certainly still be included, and you could almost rewrite that chapter with our modern-day disagreements. Whether or not a Christian should go to the movie theater, whether or not a Christian should go on a date without any chaperone, whether a Christian should take a job or he will have to miss a few Sundays a year, can you or can you not have a TV in your home? What about playing with a deck of cards? Skirts should come to a certain point on a girl and no higher, no lower, or, you know, rules about the length of shorts or tops or whatever, makeup or no makeup, earrings or no earrings, you know, wedding rings obviously are fine, but so many want to draw the line, and if it's not a wedding ring or engagement ring, then it shouldn't be worn because it's improper adornment and you're just trying to draw attention to yourself and you're trying to be flashy, and that's not what a good Christian should do. These just begin to touch the surface of some of the extras, the higher standards that we sometimes call ourselves to, even though you will not find a rule on it in the Bible. These are some of the hand washings that we have in the church today. But I'm sure there are some that you can think of, some that you have dealt with personally when somebody told you that you were basically going to hell because you were doing this or you weren't doing this, and the Bible never spoke about it. You know, Christmas is coming up here, really, and not too much longer. Some will say, I don't see how a Christian can celebrate Christmas. After all, it's pagan. It wasn't started by Christians. But then others will say, I don't see how as a Christian you don't celebrate Christmas. After all, celebrating Christ's birth, peace on earth, and goodwill toward men? And yet, the Bible is completely silent about it. We have the story of the birth of Christ, which quite frankly can and probably should be read and celebrated all throughout the year. And the word Christmas never does appear in the Bible. Okay, the opening chapters of Matthew, Matthew chapter 1, Luke chapter 1, what is often referred to as the Christmas story, the word Christmas never does appear in the Bible. The Bible did not dub that the Christmas story. It's merely the story of the birth of Christ. Okay, and I don't say the word merely to diminish it in any way, but, you know, it's not the Christmas story, but it is part of the Bible. And if you want to attach the word Christmas to it, okay, fine. But these extras, these higher standards, are not bad. But where we run into a problem is when we try and make that standard somebody else's as well. When we place that standard in the Bible when it was never there to begin with. If you don't want to celebrate Christmas because you feel it's too pagan, then fine, you don't celebrate Christmas. You ignore December 25 when it comes around. But there's nothing in the Bible that condemns the Christian if he wants to celebrate Christmas with the majority of the rest of the world. But when we place that standard in the Bible when it was never there to begin with, folks, that is a clear offense, by the way. Look at the book of Revelation. We add to or we take away from the book. That is a clear offense. But we often don't think about that, evidently. Regardless of what it's about, if that's what you want for yourself and your family, then you know what? Go to it. May the Lord bless you. But don't place that same standard on me and then judge me because I didn't do it as well. And don't expect your church to develop that standard as a part of their doctrine and regular teaching because it's not in the Bible. And if they're being honest, they will stick with only what is in the Bible. Standing during the last song before the sermon, for some, it is critically important. I'm not making this up either, by the way, okay? I've seen it. I can't say binding necessarily, but extremely important. And they will stand even if they're the only ones who are standing. And if it's not done, if they didn't stand, they walk away from church feeling let down. Friends, I have seen this happen. I've heard this. I felt let down because the song leader didn't have a stand during that last song. Seriously? We feel let down over our worship experience because of that? How much of God are we missing because of all of these extras that we place so much importance on? Because of these higher standards that we have adopted that are nowhere in the Bible, but they mean as much to us, and I wonder sometimes if they don't mean more. Now, I don't want to run this topic right into the ground, because I know this is somewhat dangerous territory for a preacher to venture into, but that's never really stopped me before. And I'm certainly not trying to make enemies. But I do think this is necessary stuff to cover because it does become a problem. And a completely unnecessary one at that. And I think we've all had an experience with this. We know what goes on. And it is something that needs to be considered. Hey, the Jews had this problem in Jesus' day. I know God's church can have this problem today. This message is just one attempt to keep that from happening, so I'm just going to give you one more example. What about the order of worship in worship? God's primary concern with worship in order is that it is done in order. 1 Corinthians 14, you can read on that. Meaning that things are not in chaos and disarray because no one really knows what anyone else is doing, but as for what happens, when, and how it is done, he seems, perhaps not so surprisingly, uninterested. Oh, but for some, things like that are a breaking point. God is displeased with our worship because we didn't do this at this time and this at this time, and we've always done it this way, and Why did we break that pattern and churches didn't feel the same? What, because we printed a bulletin and we handed it out, but then we decided to call an audible and improvise at some point? There was a Southern gospel music artist that was telling a story about one church service that he was in. And they used the bulletin, as so many churches do. Nothing wrong with the bulletins. They can be extremely helpful. But he said everything was laid out in this bulletin. He said the bulletin was put out by a secretary. They had just one secretary, and she was a part-timer. But everything was put in this bulletin. But one Sunday morning, she forgot to put the word dismiss in the bulletin, and that completely threw everything into disarray because they got to the end of the bulletin, and nobody knew what to do because the word dismiss wasn't in there. Well, can we do it or can we not? It's not in the bulletin. They sat there until 3 in the afternoon trying to figure out what to do. Finally convened a deacon's meeting and decided it was all right to go ahead and dismiss. No. He made a joke out of that situation. I doubt that they sat there until 3 in the afternoon. But he did make a very valid point. Worship became about what was in that bulletin. About the structure that they had decided they were going to use for that day. And when something was missing, even unintentionally, it throws them off. Church just doesn't feel the same way. Do you really think that God wants structured worship, where the focus of our time is spent making sure that a certain sequence of events is followed, where we spend our time making sure that, well, what's the next thing on the bulletin? What's the next thing that we're supposed to do? Or do you think he wants our time to be spent worshiping him and getting close to him and doing so with others who want the same thing and whom we might be able to help along the way? Now, I'm not saying that there should not be some sort of order, as we talked about just a minute ago, because you don't want to your worship be just in complete disarray and nobody knows what we're supposed to do or how it's supposed to be done and everything just feels so chaotic and unorganized. That is not what you want. But to feel that there's a problem in worship if the song leader decides to leave out a song or add a song, or, you know what, the preacher decides, you know what, let's do the Lord's Supper at this point instead because it, you know, and okay, it's not what you normally do from week to week, but we're gonna ad lib a little bit today. Friends, that's not out of order. It's just not the structure that you become so used to. But I don't know if we realize it or not, but when we reduce our worship to these things, to this structure, to the order and the pattern that's found in the bulletin, when we reduce our worship to these things, we are also reducing God. And the more we focus on these external things, the less we focus on God, and the more we are telling him that he's not nearly as important to us as is our structure. And the same can be said about these higher and extra standards that we hold ourselves to because we feel these things are just what a good Christian does. But the more importance we place on these, the less importance we place on God. It's as if we think that by doing these other things, by going above and beyond what God has asked of us or has required of us, that we will somehow make it to heaven easier, or maybe we'll have a better mansion. Honestly, I don't really know what we're thinking. I hope we are not thinking that we need to do these things because there's a chance that by doing so we will avoid some other sin that we may not even yet be aware of, and thereby make our chances of getting into heaven greater. Because then I would want to say, what do we really think about the grace of God? Are we that distrustful of the grace of God that we feel we have to place these higher standards on ourselves so that we can stay out of sin? Because if we don't, our chances of making heaven are a lot less? What exactly is the grace of God to us? Now, I'm not advocating for calling on the grace of God and then just charging right into sin. Roman gives a very clear warning about abusing and taking advantage of the grace of God. But I'm talking about why we feel that we need to have these extra rules that God never gave to us. Is it because we somehow feel that maybe his grace won't really be enough if we don't have these other good things to fall back on? A higher standard that we give ourselves so that we could reach heaven and point that out to God? Hey God, I did much more than you even required. Sometimes, doing much more than God required gets us in more trouble than if we just stuck to what he said. The elders had a tradition that essentially gave a lazy and irresponsible son a means to ignore the needs of his parents, even though the law said a man was to honor his father and mother and to not curse them. And the comparison Jesus makes suggests that part of that honor is taking care of them when they are no longer able to take care of themselves. But this selfish and lazy son could just say that his gift is Corban, a gift dedicated to God, regardless of whether it actually goes to anything for the temple of God or not. And he is suddenly no longer obligated to take care of his parents because he said the magic words. Magic words that never originated with God. The extras got them in trouble. Most writers agree that Corban was an idea created so that just such a lazy person could reject the needs of his parents and still feel good about himself. It was a loophole. The problem with coming up with these higher standards is when you come up with too many of them. When you have a rule for everything, eventually the rules start overlapping one another and they start tripping over one another, and your rule book looks like a street map of Manhattan. And to obey rule number 3, you have to break rule number 9. And to obey rule number 9, you have to break rule number 13. And you don't even realize that to obey your own code of ethics above and beyond anything in the Bible, you have to simultaneously break that same code. Which means that your whole purpose has failed anyway because you are still breaking rules. The more rules you have, the more likely you are to break them because you have so many of them. You're familiar with the Medes and the Persians, you know, like Daniel chapter 6, Darius the Mede, Daniel in the lion's den, and all of that. Well, the thing about the Medes and the Persians was they were all about their established laws, right? This, issuing and signing laws so that it cannot be changed, an official law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. That was their thing, and that was how they signed laws. This is the law, and it didn't matter how ludicrous it really was after you read it after the fact. Didn't matter. It's law. Can't be changed. That's just what they did, right? But this devotion to established laws... While it was one of the special features of the Persian Empire, finally, the profusion of laws, it so swamped them in bureaucracy that they could not function efficiently. They literally had lawed themselves into a corner. Okay? And this is a little bit what I was talking about just a minute ago, when to obey rule number 3, you've got to break rule 9, and to obey rule 9, you've got to break rule 13. That's acting like the Medes and the Persians. We've lawed ourselves into a corner. Well, we just don't think that this is something that a good Christian should do. Well, okay, that's fine. Except when these things that we don't think a good Christian should do sometimes make their way into the Bible and practically become a part of our doctrine, and we determine whether a person's actions are okay or not based on these rather than basing it solely on what the Bible says. Now, if we want to think these things and live these things for ourselves, that's fine. But if it's not actually in the Bible, don't put it there. And Jesus goes on to tell them that their faithful observance of their traditions, of their extras, is not making them any more holy before God. You can see that in verses 6 through 8. What they have given him is lip service, but they haven't given him their hearts, even though externally they look really good. But as we know, Jesus looks on the inside. He cares about what's going on inside a person's heart. And too many pews have been filled over the years with Christians who come up with all of these extras, all of these traditions, and higher extra biblical standards. And they feel good about themselves because of it. And they try to get others to do the same. But in the process, they are completely missing the mark that all along they thought they had hit dead center. Because moral purity and being right before God is determined by His Word. And nothing more. It is not determined by society and what they think is acceptable or not acceptable. It is not determined by the clergy at your church. It is not determined by your grandfather's tradition or that extra thing you decided you should do to be holy. It is determined by God and His Word. Jesus goes on in the last half of our text to explain where real moral purity comes from, and He does so by explaining where real defilement comes from. It does not come from anything external. The disciples' failure, and I put that word in air quotes, to wash their hands before they ate is not what would make them or anyone else defiled or morally unclean. So moral purity does not come from observing traditions or obeying these higher standards. So where does it come from? You remember verses 14 through 23. The thing about that list is that none of them are created by some outside force. You cannot take a pill and suddenly become a murderer. You don't drink a potion of adultery and suddenly you go out and commit it. You don't get a prescription for envy or greed or evil thoughts. And yet Jesus said that it's what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. Nothing that he puts into his body, but how do these things get inside a man in the first place? What goes out must first go in, right? It's kind of like that old adage or whatever, what goes up must come down. What goes out must first have gone in, right? And I know that I didn't ask anyone to infect me with any of these. I didn't go out and look for them, so how did they get there? We are, by nature, sinful people. Sin is in our nature. That's why Jesus died, was so that nature would not have to control us and ultimately kill our souls. But we are, by nature, sinful people. You didn't ask to be made a sinful person. You just are. James chapter 1. Verses 13 through 15. And remember, when you're being tempted, do not say, God is tempting me. God is never tempted to do wrong, and He never tempts anyone else. Temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. These desires give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death. Sin starts as a little seed that is already inside each of us. It's when this seed is fed with all the right ingredients and given the opportunity to grow that it sprouts and grows up and eventually becomes a full-blown action, actions which Jesus has included in this list. And Paul speaks of his own struggle with sin in Romans 7, where even he admits that sin is always inside of him. And this is the truth for everybody. We don't have to learn how to sin. We have to learn how not to sin. To sin is by nature, but to not sin is to go against what is natural, and that is what makes it hard. We don't have to learn how to curse, we have to learn how not to curse. Because to curse is natural. And if you don't believe me about that, go out there and slam your hand in the car door and you let me know what comes out of your mouth. Because I guarantee you something's come out of your mouth, and it may not be, ouch, or, well, that hurt. There's just something about a good curse in that situation that just makes it feel like it's beginning to heal, right? This will make the pain go away. It's natural to curse in such a situation. The hard part is not throwing out that curse word when you experience that sudden onslaught of pain. For that something to be anything besides a curse is something that you have to learn, because it's natural to curse. It's not natural not to curse. If you want to sum up what living the Christian life really is, you could do it this way. You have to do what is unnatural. Because what is natural is to sin. And that's not to say that everything that is by or is within our nature is sinful. It's not. We are by nature people who want to care for and love someone. And we want by that same nature someone to care for and love us. That is certainly not sinful, but it is natural. It is natural for a guy and a girl to look at each other and feel something for each other, even to feel something romantically for each other. That is a beautiful thing that God has ingrained into our nature, and it is how beautiful families who love and care for each other are created. And we should embrace those things in our nature instead of feeling embarrassed or ashamed or thinking that we shouldn't talk about them. Our nature does, though, also have sinful and harmful tendencies, harmful to ourselves and harmful to others. And these are the things that God would have us stay away from. This is why we have the Bible. It is why we have His Word, His law, His will for our lives written down and preserved for us. It is why we have the promise of His strength and help to overcome that natural part of us that can hurt us if it's left uncontrolled. Friends, it's the attitudes and actions of your heart that decide moral purity. Your traditions, your higher standards, they won't make you any better of a Christian in the eyes of God. They will not get you into heaven any easier than anybody else. You certainly can't use them as a bargaining tool on the day of judgment or use them as a credit for when you really do something bad that's against every code ever written in the Bible. And trying to impose those higher standards on me will not make me any better of a Christian either. These higher standards will not protect our hearts from the blossoming of sin any more than God already does with His Word. These higher standards and traditions usually just become lip service. External things that make us look and sound really good, but has absolutely no bearing on what is going on inside our hearts, which is where real moral impurity comes from if sin is given a chance to blossom and grow. Do you want to be pure? I recommend that you just stick with the Bible, because it is the tried and true. It is what will teach you the right way. It will be your guide, and you can certainly trust its author. You can spend a lot of time trying to observe various traditions and extra standards, but you are better served just spending that time in the words of God, learning what His will is for your life, and try spending a little less time worrying about what standard the person next to you is living by, because He has shown you what defiles a man. And to eat with unwashed hands, or to celebrate Christmas, or to not celebrate Christmas, to own a TV, or to play with a deck of cards, take your pick. Those things do not defile a man.